Good Earth Sunday morning to all of us. I hope you are enjoying our modest attempt to recreate the Garden of Eden up here. You have to have a bit of imagination, of course. It was probably a bit bigger, probably a few more flowers, and food. I haven't quite gotten to the food part yet this morning. But welcome. I'm glad you're here. That we are people created to live in and care for God's creation. That's the story we just heard from Genesis 2. So today's text is sort of an origin story. It's a story that provided a way for the people of Israel and subsequent generations to understand from a faith perspective where we came from and why. It's a story. And as we worship together here today on Earth Sunday 2023, can also, I think, serve as an extended metaphor for what God may be trying to tell us in these many centuries later. But remember, it's a story. It's not intended in any way to compete with scientific versions of how we and life as we knew it came to be. They're very different, needless to say. The garden in this story, the garden is the center of the story, but it is the soil, the adama, that is essential. It is not scenery. It's the stuff that is capable of absorbing water. And God had not yet provided water. And so this story begins with, we need water. We need people to do the work. This is the garden. What needs to happen now? The soil was essential. The water was essential for cultivation. It also supported life. The earth is the stuff from which the earth creature, the human, is formed. Picture God playing in the dirt, and voila, there's life. It takes a lot of imagination to be a first century Christian who is hearing this for the first time. In other words, human existence is portrayed as, from the very beginning, as inextricably related to that which makes life possible. Dirt, water, and let's not forget, divine presence. The earth creature is not identified as having a gender. Apparently the need for pronouns didn't, was a little bit further down on God's to-do list. The creature is simply a being created from the earth who finds itself in a verdant garden, which the human is invited to till and to keep, to be responsible for, to steward. Then we're told God is concerned that this earth creature needs a companion and animal life is created. Helpful, wonderful, useful, but not quite what the earth creature might have had in mind. So God goes back to work and a more appropriate partner is created. And so it is that gendered life becomes part of the garden. And the earth creature, now known as Adam, coming from the earth, the Adama, the earth creature is now Adam, bursts into song. Once the characters are in place, the story moves on. It turns out that life in this garden, while abundant, has limits. Eat anything you want, God says. But there are two trees that we really shouldn't be part of. Don't eat from those two trees. So, of course, the couple, aided by a wily serpent, begins to question, why not? Why can't we have it all? They're human, after all. And foolishly, they assume that God, God won't really mind. Let's just have a taste. Well, you know the rest. Like every young verbal human, They don't like it when a parental figure says no. They have plenty of food, but they want more. They don't want to be limited by God or anything else. Does this sound like any two-year-olds you may have known? And it doesn't take long for God to say enough and show them the gate. They're gone from the garden. It's a simple and pretty obvious lesson. To live in God's world, you need to live by God's rules. It's also a hard lesson, and one that we humans are still struggling, I'm afraid, to understand and achieve. So it seems that this story is not about gender hierarchy or original sin or any of the other things that theologians have been fretting about for the last centuries and centuries and centuries. It's about consumption. What should and should not be consumed. And to our contemporary ears, perhaps, it's also about the extent to which the garden, the earth, should be exploited for personal gain and human profit, and to the detriment of the planet. Let's now fast forward a bit to the early church. Some decades ago, two scholars, Rita Nakashima Brock and Rebecca Ann Parker, traveled to the Mediterranean to study how the early church captured its life in its art and worship. So they started from the catacombs. That's where it all began, in the catacombs, and everywhere from there on. And everywhere they went, they saw similar images. There were no crucifixes, no crosses, no images of a suffering Jesus. They could not find images of the dead Jesus anywhere. And why was that? Because to the early church, Jesus was not dead. Jesus was alive. So wherever there was an image of Jesus in the early church, on the walls of the sanctuaries, wherever, he was alive and well and doing the kind of things that we know of him doing during his life on earth in his ministry, feeding people, healing people, having meals with friends and followers. This is a very familiar Jesus, in other words, present again in the midst of the early church. The paintings, in essence, because of the greenery and the animals and all the other things that were part of it, told the early church, in essence, that Jesus' death and resurrection created a pathway back to Eden. Paradise is on earth. Heaven is not off in the future somewhere after you live a good life. Paradise, life in intimate contact with God and God's will for us, is now. It's here. And this was known by the early church, which also saw itself as a community of the resurrection. Baptism for the early church was literally called the portal to paradise. Through the waters of baptism, Christians once more are welcome in the Garden of Eden. The story is depicted in this garden as one of sharing, of healing, of peace, of balance. There is beloved community in all parts of the creation, plants, animals, and humans. Live and flourish together, and no one seems to be griping about wanting more. Strange. These are human beings. Why aren't they complaining? But why should they? Their communion tables were laden not just with bread and wine, as this one is, but with fruit and nuts and grains, reminiscent of the very foods that were available in the garden. We perhaps yearn to return a bit to Eden ourselves. But how can that be possible? We are a people now more inclined to consumption than ever before in history. We refuse to acknowledge the need for limits. Too often we say no But even more, we demand more. And the consequences are becoming ever more evident and alarming. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released its latest report a few weeks ago, just as our climate action team was beginning to plan this day. According to the UN General Assembly, humanity is on thin ice, and that ice is melting fast. He went on to call for climate action on all fronts, everything, everywhere, all at once. This doesn't sound like an international bureaucrat to me. It sounds like a person who really cares. There are five quick points about this report. One, the time is now. The crisis is urgent, but there is still time. Two, there is, however, a rapidly closing window of opportunity to secure a livable and sustainable future for all. But if that doesn't happen, and if it doesn't happen soon, we should expect millions of our fellow humans to be on the move to a place where they might be able to fare better than in their homeland. That's called climate migration, and it's already happening. Three, without strengthening of worldwide regulations about carbon emissions, global warming of 3.2 degrees Celsius is projected by 2100. That is a mere 77 years from now, a reasonable lifetime for someone who's now a young child. Four, every region of the world is projected to face further increases in climate-related hazards, like weather. And five, public and private finance flow, money going into the cause, flows much more greatly in support of fossil fuel than it does for climate adaptation and mitigation. We humans have been putting tons of CO2 into the air on a regular basis since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. It's got to stop, and here are a few reasons why. The glaciers and the polar ice caps are melting, and oceans are warming, forcing water levels to rise, which then critically affect many low-lying islands and lovely coastal beaches where we like to vacation, not to mention entire island nations like the Philippines and Bangladesh. Those warming waters also bring on serious storms, stronger and more violent, and way more frequent than we have ever experienced. And the cost of rebuilding both homes and infrastructure after such storms is overwhelming and often interminably slow. The warming air dries out the land and the plant life as it did in a community ironically called Paradise in California. It was a dry season, the earth was parched, and plant life was brittle with thirst. All it took was a lot of wind and a spark from an inadequately maintained PG&E power line, and within hours, mere hours, 85 people were dead, and their community, called Paradise, was virtually no longer existent. Rising water temperatures are also affecting the coral reefs and endangering sea life, and thus affecting the economies of fishing communities, those who have no other ways to sustain themselves. And many coastal areas are also being damaged by rising seawater from the storms that bring seawater up onto the land and ruins both cropland and forests, making life untenable. Vast areas of Africa are becoming uninhabitable due to many things, including drought. People leave their land and head to the border and ultimately a port in the hope of finding a way to survive. And if they are able to find a boat that can take them somewhere, anywhere, just take me away where I can live, they may well capsize en route or be turned back upon arrival at a Greek island or a European entry point. It's in the news way too often. Whether from lack of water or too much of it, these are climate refugees, and their numbers are growing by the year. People come to the U.S. borders for a variety of reasons as well. Poverty, violence, war, hope for a better life. But climate change is contributing more significantly with each year that passes. And on a global scale, including the U.S., but on a global scale, national and international resources are being put forward to address migration as a national security issue. In many cases, that means that migrants are seen as a threat. These people are starving, travel-worn, torn from their homes, seeking refuge in a place that is, at least for the time being, relatively livable. And they are being met by surveillance systems and armed guards. And plans are being made for even more repressive measures in the future. Our tax dollars at work. Several years ago, the Department of Homeland Security hauled in chunks of World War II era wall left over from the Normandy invasion, from the looks of them, and stuck them in the ground in the near the U.S.-Mexico border in southern Arizona. The air was parched from drought, barren of vegetation, and overgrazed by cattle. And when Hurricane Odile blew through the area in 2014 with an unprecedented wind and rain, it picked up a piece of that wall, blew it past the international border, and finally dropped it somewhere in northern Mexico. I'll get back to you with the rest of that story in a minute. Is there a pathway back to Eden? I think there is, but it will take some change on everyone's part. Us will have to change. Policymakers and politicians definitely have to change. And corporations, let's not forget corporations, especially the oil and gas industry, that's really going to have to think about the priorities for the survival of this planet. And perhaps it might affect how they do their work. I'm an aging baby boomer. It's often been said that it's up to us, our generation, we older people past 60, well past 60 in some cases, to lead the way in order to create a livable planet for our children and grandchildren. But the current and more stronger message now is that it's not really up to us. Rather, our job is to listen to the demands of our children and grandchildren and be prepared to form intergenerational alliances to help them lead the way. We were part of creating the problem. We should help them be the leaders of the solution. Whatever your age, if your annual income is more than $38,000 a year, you're in the top 10% of the global income spectrum. I would wager that that's would involve quite a few of us. But whatever our income, we all need to take a long, hard look at our climate legacy. Jack was talking about the legacy of involving our church finances, but there's also a climate legacy in terms of our personal lifestyles. What kind of a car do we drive? How often do we hop on a plane and fly off somewhere? Or do we occasionally hop on a MAX or a bus or take a train? We also need to assess our political and political, economic, and cultural systems that we help create and support and empower. Do the answers to these questions represent the legacy that you want to leave? If not, it's time, as it is probably for all of us, to take stock. Several years ago, in the midst of a global pandemic with a lockdown church, this congregation set about developing a new strategic plan, which was subsequently adopted by the congregation. One of the plan's goals was for Plymouth to become a vital force for racial, economic, and, this is new, environmental justice. And that is how our current Climate Action Ministry team came to be. You'll be soon be hearing about more steps that we will be taking in order to become a creation justice congregation of the United Church of Christ. The UCC has been a leader in this area, and it began with a clear focus on environmental justice, not merely saving the creation so that we can enjoy its beauty and maybe have cleaner air to breathe, rather to be faithful communities that will work to assure that clean air and toxin-free water and arable land is available to all. Current efforts are centered largely around climate change and the need for just transition to assure that people and communities that are economically displaced by our movement away from fossil fuels will be able to find new ways to sustain themselves as we as a nation transition to sustaining ourselves and the earth with different forms of energy. It's a huge issue, particularly for those of us in the western states like Colorado, where so much of our current economy is centered on the fossil fuel-related industries. So what can we do? There is an Earth Sunday Fair out in Fellowship Hall today, and where you can learn about some of what Plymouth members are doing and what the church itself is doing and hopes to do. And you can also visit with some fascinating guests from the community, some guy called the Worm Guy, whatever. Check it out. And check out a survey as well from CAM, the Climate Action Ministry, to test your interests and encourage your involvement in this work here at Plymouth. Plymouth has been working at this for some time, but there are some recent upticks that you might have missed. Here are a few. With the help of money available through the City of Fort Collins, we are in the process of transitioning a significant portion of our lighting to LED. Because we use the North Wing and Fellowship Hall to shelter homeless families through Faith, Family, and Hospitality, that portion of the transition will be covered in full by the funds from the city. This is called collaboration. It's wonderful. The flowers that adorn our mini Eden this morning will be planted outside our sanctuary windows. If the sermon gets boring, you can always look at them, right? They will also attract not just your eyes, but the Creator's eyes, and they will attract butterflies and pollinators of other kinds, and they will use less water because of changes in our irrigating system. And at the recommendation of the Climate Action Ministry team last year, Leadership Council voted to move our endowment funds to the Beyond Fossil Fuels option within the United Church funds, where our funds are invested. If you are considering a gift to Plymouth's endowment, and this is the season for the question to be asked, you can be sure that any money you invest in our endowment will not be used to build pipelines to bring oil from Alberta to Commerce City or anywhere else in the lower 48. And conversations are underway to explore how we might address the needed repairs that could help us as a church lower our carbon footprint every time we turn on the heat or the air conditioning. It's still in the if you can dream it, it might happen stage, but stay tuned. There will be news to come. Since we began with the story about the beginning of the inhabited world in a verdant garden, I'd like to close with another one. Remember that piece of border wall I mentioned a bit ago, the one that blew away from the border in southern Arizona and during a hurricane? And well, it landed in a fragile part of northern Mexico, just east of the Agua Prieta Douglas entry point. When Todd Miller, a journalist based in the Southwest, visited the area, he came across it. It was lying in the in a dry area, formerly dry area. I'm giving it away here. It was lying near a wash. It was covered with dust and cobwebs and a lot of little purple flowers. It seemed to him like a beautiful work of art till he realized what it was. This is part of the border wall, trying to keep immigrants out. It was embedded 15 feet deep in the riverbed, where wire cages filled with rocks were placed. This was a return to an ancient technique of placing stones in riverbeds in order to slow down the flow of water. And after years of mechanized farming, cattle production, and now a nasty drought, this parched and barren landscape was once again able to absorb precious water as it gently flowed rather than rampaged. They're called washes because the water goes through and takes the soil with it. I used to live in Tucson. I know a lot about washes and people who stupidly get their cars stuck in them and they die. It's not a pretty picture. So because of these stones, because of the wisdom of the ancient people in that part of the world, this riverbed was no longer full of rampaging water. It was gently flowing water, which allowed time for the soil to be replenished and capable of stimulating new life. Before, rushing water from the monsoon storms would strip away the topsoil and leave erosion. But now there was water year-round, not just a week or two in August. There were native grasses and sprouting desert willows and cottonwoods. The water table had risen 30 feet in the middle of a 15-year drought. That's an amazing story. Comment. Everywhere else, the drought was sucking water out of the land as usual, and animals, grass, and the earth itself were dying. Yet here, 15 miles downstream as well, water was returning and recharging the earth. All this in a place where people had not seen water for over a decade. Bees were returning, butterflies were returning. The land went from brown to green, from completely dry to lush and abundant. It must have felt for all the world like a miracle and looked, dare I say, like a bit of Eden in the midst of the Sonoran Desert. Within sight of the international border, just a few miles away, with its border patrol vehicles and sophisticated technology, there was a re-emerging paradise. And as no respecters of boundaries, this water table rose not just on the Mexico side, but the U.S. side as well. Just think, Miller mused, what could happen if the $20 billion that the U.S. uses annually for border and immigration enforcement for exclusion could be used to restore the land itself? For starters, many people would be able to stay in Mexico and continue to farm their ancestral lands. And at least some of the climate-driven migration could end. There is a pathway back to Eden. The question is, what kind of changes are we in the global north willing to make to assure the survival of our fellow humans and prevent the unnecessary desperation that so often leads to migration? And then we must create systems within societies throughout the world so there indeed is equity and justice for all. I believe that Eden is still there and waiting for us. The real question is, will we be able to make enough change for this garden we call home, for it to be able to return to its regenerated lushness? And how can each of us become less of the problem and more of the solution? And I wonder, how will it differ from the world in which we now live? Here are some questions I wonder about. Will at least some of the endangered species we worry about still be here? Will there be energy sources that assure a good life for all the Earth inhabitants without endangering the health and future of any? Will we all, or at least more of us, be vegetarian? Will there be justice? Will there still be plastic? This one really makes me wonder. Will abandoned oil rigs be transformed into wind machines or maybe the home for huge solar installations? These are important things to wonder about. What are we going to do with those things sitting out in the ocean? And the ultimate question, will our grandchildren's grandchildren be having grandchildren of their own? I hope the answers to all these questions and all the others we may have is a resounding yes, may it be so. And so I say, and I hope you join me, yes, may it be so. Amen.